This is Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B.
Hello there. Welcome to Life Elsewhere. I'm Norman B. Later in the show, excuse me if you hear me drooling, my guest is New Orleans-based chef Kelly Fields. Her good book of Southern baking, A Revival of Biscuits, Cakes, and Cornbread, has me almost devouring every page. Yes, we talk about pastries, pies, and puddings, but we also get into why Chef Kelly is so passionate about her culinary skills. But the star chef also explains how the pandemic has helped her take a fresh look at life and being inspired by the music of Slater Kinney. Now first, listen to this. On a 90-degree summer day, I stood ankle-deep in rotting trash fish on a loading dock, left for days as they waited to be transformed into the protein base of an aquaculture pyramid. Those were some strong sniffs. Yet none of it, not the trash fish nor the fecal lagoons, was as fundamentally gross and disturbing as the smell that came out of a fish case in Manhattan, in a Whole Foods, in one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the wealthiest nation on earth. That's the gruesome and vivid description of the occasional cleansing of a fish counter in an upscale supermarket. It's also the opening to a new book, The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket, by my first guest, Benjamin Law. Benjamin Law, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you, Norman.
You go into explicit detail about the cleaning of the fish counter. Can you give us just a little example?
Parts of the fish drip down there and then get stuck down there for weeks at a time that you got this horrendous, horrendous smell. And for me, that captured so much of what I saw in the grocery store, and so much of that subtitle, The Dark Miracle. The top consumer-facing part was hygienic, it was clean, it was a perfect platform to sell good fish, and then you started rooting through to the bottom, and what you found was horrifying. And I'm glad you put that quote in context, because I smelled some terrible things when writing this book. And that smell was, I wasn't dramatizing it for the metaphor. It was gross.
Well, that sets up the tone for the book, because you have managed, and I want to compliment you on this, you have managed somehow to write a story that is, it's like a thriller in some respects. It's like an adventure story. Yet you're giving us facts and details, and at the same time, you're making me sometimes kind of chuckle, and then you're also making me be sort of like, oh my God, wonderful stuff, great writing. I really enjoyed reading your book. You take us in so many different directions, and you take us into different places that I quite frankly, I think, and you know this, I wasn't sure that I wanted to go to. But having said that, you also take us to places that I was fascinated by. I've got to touch on the story of Trader Joe, and you go into great detail about this.
Yeah, no, he was really at the start of the book in my mind. I had written, my previous book was on Bikram yoga, and it was this kind of look at this cult community and this obsessive practice, and that book got very dark, and the guru behind that, the book led to women coming out and accusing him of sexual assault. But during one of his teacher trainings, I watched all these yogis pour into a Trader Joe's, and their faces just light up with complete delight. And I just wanted to understand how this store functioned, because the employees there seemed super happy. The products they were selling seemed super novel and interesting and attractive to me. And it all just seemed too good to be true. And I was thrilled to actually get to meet Trader Joe himself. He died earlier this year, sadly. But there's a happy ending there. He was just a real visionary, a real humanist, who looked at the grocery industry and figured out how to shrink the offerings of the store so it wasn't overwhelming to his buyers, allowed them the freedom to find value for customers, and kind of exploded the notion that the grocery store just needs to sell the same continuous products, the Bounty paper towels and Coca-Cola that are bombed out in continuous fashion everywhere else, and could kind of cultivate a consumer who is getting something slightly different and who would be interested in something slightly different. And getting a sense of how his brain worked was one of the big pleasures of the book. And it was very unexpected. I went into the Trader Joe section being like, this is going to be too good to be true. And I'm going to like have to spoil Trader Joe's for everyone. And that was absolutely not true of what I found when Trader Joe was running the chain.
You know, one thing that comes across in your book, in the stories that you tell, including Trader Joe, is your, and I'm sort of getting into your head in a little bit, is your like and your dislike, and you'll see your observations about people, particularly Trader Joe and his wife, Joe and his wife. As you just said, you kind of liked him.
Oh, absolutely. I was charmed.
Charmed by him,
I was completely charmed by him. I think in the book, I'm very suspicious of that charm, because I do think it mirrors the way that Trader Joe's operates as a whole. Joe had this ability. He would just seemed like the most decent human I had ever encountered. And he, I think, was self-aware of his ability to project that decency. And I think that that's very similar to how Trader Joe's operates as a store. You know, a lot of the products on their shelves get this halo from being selected by Trader Joe's.
Yes.
And become, you know, even though Trader Joe's at this point specializes in frozen items that are, you know, the same gelatinous things we would call TV dinners, minus some, you know, they tweak the supply, their supply chain.
Yes.
And they get rid of some ingredients like MSG and reduce sugar count. But largely they're what I would call TV dinners. And yet when they're in Trader Joe's, people suddenly think of them with this health halo around them. And I was fascinated by his ability to do that, both as an individual and as a store.
Yeah, and you talk about nuts, about how he discovered the whole idea of selling nuts and making those so needed. I mean, it was an incredible story.
He got fascinated with, so Trader Joe was a true green, that's how he would say it. He was ecologically conscious. He read an article in 1970, Scientific American, that was about the biosphere. And he said, you know what, like the world is, we need to protect our world. And he started planting living Christmas trees after that. But he never bought into the idea of health foods. He didn't see the connection between eating healthy and saving the world, because in many cases, there isn't one. You might be saving yourself a little bit, but eating healthy isn't. But he quickly realized his customers really wanted that. So he learned the lingo of the health food world, and then was confronted with the problem that a lot of the actual health food products like bran were completely went against his rules as a retailer. He was obsessed with getting high cost per cubic inch products, like high density cost objects, because you could sell them for a lot of money and they don't take up a lot of shelf space. But bran and these other health foods were enormously voluminous. You could fill a whole room with bran and you would sell it for cheap. And it was just this awful product he didn't want to be associated with as a retailer. So he got involved with nuts, because the bran supplier would also bring those in. And it turned out years later that now everyone thinks of nuts as healthy, but it had nothing to do with why he got into them. He got into nuts to pay for bran.
Once again, I love the way you tell the story. That's the real charm of your book. The book is called The Secret Life of Groceries, and my guest is Benjamin Law. Something that you do in your book, which I think is fascinating, is you give us a lot of details, a lot of facts and figures, without being academic about it, how much we spend on groceries in America.
$700 billion in 2018, you know, 38,000 stores across the land. We're spending 2% of our lives in these stores. I mean, the raw volume, and that is something that I think is like, I just wanted to beat people over the head with this, because to me, I'm just magnetized by the grocery experience. When you walk down the aisles, there's this both relaxation and you're basking in the privilege that they provide, but also they radiate a certain power. And I feel like that comes across with those numbers. And it was something that in every part of the chain, you know, it's like when I travel with truckers for a chapter of, and I have no idea how big the trucking industry was. It's a, you know, 10 billion tons of freight moved around per year, which breaks down to 350 pounds per person. That's man, woman, child, per day. Is yes. being hauled around on behalf of all of us. I mean, there's that our lives are given to us on trucks.
Yes.
And you can't understand how the industry functions. And when we get to the darker parts of the book, and it does get dark, you can't understand why those are created if you don't understand the volume that people are dealing with, they're struggling with. If you're a buyer, you're in charge of 70 categories of products. And, you know, that can result in thousands of what they call stock keeping unit or SKUs, individual products that, that a buyer is responsible for. Getting a hold of it is not something that you can, it's not a human scale endeavor. And again, to go back to Trader Joe, that's one of the, his things that he did was he said, you know what, I'm opting out of bigger is better. I'm going to scale this down to a human scale. I'm going to shrink the SKU count in my store down to a manageable level. And we're going to go from there. But it was really in opposition to much of the industry.
Benjamin, let's talk about SKUs for a moment, because that's something that I think the average shopper in a supermarket is not thinking about. Whereas behind the scenes, as you say, the managers, the people involved, the buyers, they're not talking in terms of food. Food never comes into it, you write. It's products. It's nothing to do with food. And SKUs is so important. Can you just give my listeners just a little understanding of what SKU means?
Well, it's a stock keeping unit. And I think what it means is that the objects that the buyer and the manager and me and you think of as food transubstantiates into something different when you get to thinking of as a retail product. And buyers are responsible for growing their margin. At the end of the day, they need to make money. And so the qualities that get them that bottom line growth are the qualities that they care for more than anything. And that doesn't map on to necessarily the best product. It doesn't map on to the tastiest, most delicious product. It maps on to all these other qualities that are very intricate, how the section is set up and what are the competing products. So if you have a very high quality private label product that is also cheap, and then you have your like extremely gourmet version of the same product that is being sold at a higher margin, those two collide and cannibalize sales. And so as a category manager, you're going to have to do something about that, because even though you're offering two very high quality products, your bottom line is probably suffering because of that high quality private label. And there's just intricacies like that throughout the chain that don't occur to us as consumers, but it's the way that the grocery manager must think about his product.
Yes. You know, as I'm reading your book, The Secret Life of Groceries, Benjamin, I kept thinking about, I go to the grocery store, to my local public supermarket. I go almost every day because that's the way, coming from where I come from the UK, shopping every day was a kind of a normal thing. In America, mm-hmm. it's not so much. And I was, as I'm reading your book, I'm thinking about how the local supermarket, the public supermarket that I go to, has in the last year or so started indulging in, and I mean indulging in, gourmet products. I mean, organic this and organic that, and specialty products. They have a British aisle. They have a, you know, they have a Mediterranean aisle, and they have gourmet sections and a gourmet cheese selection, which 3 years ago wouldn't have existed in a supermarket, not in a, you know, but in a general chain.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Well, I can. To a certain extent, that was one of the fascinating, you know, I went from this book about this cultish yoga community to a
yes.
book about cultish food behavior. And to me, it was a more intuitive leap than I thought it would be, than maybe it appears to other people, in the sense that somewhere over the course of my life, food became much more than food. You know, going to the American supermarket in the 1980s and food was food. It was just this product you would get to eat. And now it became this signifier of identity.
Yes.
In ways that I think was a profound shift. You can see it in the media landscape. You had Julia Child with one, you know, how to cook show that was live to, you know, video. And then right now we have two whole networks. So, you know, that offer 24-hour content on food, competing with X number of, you know, 20,000 blogs on the of content. And when we think of food, we don't think of it as food anymore. It's connection to our kin, our ancestors, a signifier of how virtuous we are and how globally conscious we are and how we're helping people and participating in a world ecosystem, or how we're greening the planet, or how we're, you know, enhancing our muscles and showing how thin or how strong or whatever adjective and self-descriptor you want to throw on it, food can help you manifest that self.
Yes, yes. And the sort of hierarchical aspect of it and the sort of elitism of it has really taken over. In 1 mile air radius where I live, there's a Publix, there's a Fresh Market, there's a Trader Joe's, there's a Rolling Oats, there's a Sprouts. I mean, you've got everything. Benjamin, you talked about the dark side of things and the dark parts of your book. I mean, it starts off in some respects pretty dark. We're talking about the fish case and cleaning that. I mean, it's more smelly than dark, I guess. But for you, what is the real sort of the biggest sort of gruesome part that you discovered in writing the book?
Yeah, that's a good question. So that opening metaphor works because a lot of the darkness is not customer facing, and a lot of the darkness is done in service of the consumer. And I think, so to answer your question, rather than, I think the darkest parts of the book occur deep in the supply chain. And I think going into writing this book, I thought of the supply chain was going to exist as some kind of corporate flow chart that goes from point A to point B with big arrows, and the product is shipped from one place to the other. But because of the volume that we were just discussing and the fact that this is billions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of metric tons worth of product, that's not how supply chains work. They're not smooth lines. They're intricate, overlapping hash marks of product lines that are aggregated at different points from good actors and bad actors alike. And visibility through the supply chain is very difficult to come by, even for the people who are purchasing, even for people who are outside and are just there to supervise and audit the supply chains. Getting that visibility is incredibly difficult. And of course, when you have lack of visibility and you have the worst instincts in humanity, can flourish because there's lack of oversight there and there's intense price pressure at the same time. And so at the bottom of the supply chain, often in places that are outsourced, but I have no doubt that it's happening right here at home in America too, you get horrendous labor abuses. And I spent time in Thailand and Myanmar with fishermen who are trafficked laborers. There's really no other word to describe them than slaves. They were bought and sold, often bought out of prison and then sold to a ship captain. They were beaten to work. They were working horrendous hours, 20 hours a day on these boats, and they were kept out there for years at a time. And what's interesting is it's so, you know, you can encapsulate that horror, and I think I do a good job of humanizing that. But to understand its place in the chain is difficult because it comes from the pressures that stores are doing on our behalf. There's a quest to lower prices every year. If you're a first world buyer going to Thailand to buy your seafood, you're asking your manufacturers for lower prices every year. And there are all these structural requirements for shrimp, for instance, which is what I focus on in the book, that you have to buy into to play the shrimp commodity game. You have to have the safety standards down. You have to get your ethical your certifications in. You have to use the right type of feed for the fish. And those are all structural costs. The one place where there's some room to give is labor. And so when people come and ask for, you know, apply price pressure, labor is where the cuts occur. And each step of the chain that gets amplified until you get to this place where that volume of demand turns into a volume of cruelty that it's really hard to stomach.
You paint that in the latter part of your book so incredibly well, so much so that I was going to the supermarket yesterday evening and I was going to make some pasta with some shrimp. And you know what? Because I read your book, I stopped and thought, maybe I'll do something else instead. Benjamin, you took you
what, 3 years to write this book?
Well, it took about 5 years, about 3 years of research and then 2 years of writing. I just want to go back to one point that you made.
Yes.
I didn't want this book to be one of those books that's shaming you into not getting certain products, precisely because I think these concerns are so structural and because there aren't easy answers. Like, not buying shrimp will not cure the problem in Thailand that is
absolutely
crippling
right.
the migrant labor. It will make us feel, because I have the same impulses. I'm not trying now to say that it was a bad idea. I also somewhat avoid shrimp, but that's not going to solve the problem.
No.
The migrant laborers who are working in that want to work, and they are often making that arduous trek and then become imprisoned because there are jobs there. So simply up and moving from the sector doesn't actually alleviate the underlying global inequities that are causing this. And it just points to, like, using the grocery store to solve deep fundamental issues and how our world is structured, it's not the way to go. We're not going to purchase our way into a better world. We're going to have to build actual sustainable systems and then get workers who are stakeholders and shareholders in their businesses and build treaties with, you know, trade treaties with teeth and enforcement and empowerment of unions. Like, these are the things that are going to cause change.
Thank you so much for pointing that out, because I totally agree with you. And that's something I didn't want to come across like I was trying to save the world in that.
I didn't take it that way.
In the very short amount of time we have left, the big takeaway for the reader, what is it that you would like people to understand about the secret life of groceries?
Oh, I don't know. I want them to be able to marvel at how amazing a system we've built and to appreciate the consequences of that miracle and to become a little bit more aware of their role, our role in creating that, which is to say that the pressures that are being applied down the chain start at the checkout counter, and they start with a store that is structured to give people abundance, continuous products, lots of choice, and low price and high quality. And those are qualities that don't map easily onto each other. And the store is struggling to meet those demands. And the result of that struggle is not always pretty. So I think, one, an appreciation for just what a miracle our lives are right now. And two, thinking about how we can recalibrate ourselves and build systems to restrain our worst, pickiest, selfish impulses.
It's a wonderful book. There's so many other things I'd like to touch on, like cardboard. You talk about that, and packaging. There's so many areas in your book that I'd love to discuss. It is a terrific read. The book is called The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarkets. My guest, Benjamin Law. Benjamin, thank you so very much for joining us at Life Elsewhere.
Thank you, Norman. It was a true pleasure. Thank you so much for the careful read.
All the details about the books and music we feature on Life Elsewhere are always up at lifeelsewhere.co. Go there to find all the places you can hear Life Elsewhere and Life Elsewhere music, and subscribe so you can keep up to date with our programming. Coming up, we stay in the realm of food. My conversation with celebrated pastry chef Kelly Fields on her delicious new book, The Good Book of Southern Baking. First, a little musical food connection with what I think is certainly the best pop song so far this year. It's Porridge Radio with 7 Seconds.
For you, and you know that I
The book is called The Good Book of Southern Baking, a revival of biscuits, cakes, and cornbread. And the chef, Kelly Fields, is with me. Chef Kelly Fields, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Kelly, I'm going to be totally honest with you and tell you that this book, which I'm holding up for our Zoom viewers to see, is a wonderful book, but it's an annoying book at the same time because I want to eat everything in this book. There's so many wonderful recipes, and if there's one thing that I love about being in the kitchen, and that is baking. But I've heard over the years people talk about baking. They talk about the fear of baking. Have you heard that?
Yes, more than a couple times, for sure.
Talk to me about the fear of baking, what you understand people mean.
Well, I think people are intimidated by baking because it has the reputation of needing to be exact. And how it's science-based and how it's very particular. And Southern baking in particular comes from a place where we measure things with, you know, a pinch or a dollop or a scoop or a spoonful versus, you know, grams or ounces, which is, I think, what most people focus on now. So this book is sort of intended to take away the intimidation factor of baking.
Yes, and it certainly does that. You've got so many, there's over 100 recipes in here, and you've made it so very easy for people to understand how to make these recipes. Let's start and talk about you and talk about Chef Kelly Fields and where you're from and how you got into baking, and just give us a little background because it's a fascinating story.
Sure. I grew up right outside of Charleston, South Carolina, and we lived on the water, and my mom has always been an avid gardener, so we grew a lot of our own produce. So I grew up in a place where I would come home from school and go shrimping or fishing or whatever and catch something to cook dinner for the family and pick something out of the backyard. And so baking has always been, and cooking has always been part of my life. And I didn't realize until the mid-90s that you could do it as a career. And I had moved to New Orleans in 1996 and helped a friend whose parents owned a bakery. They needed some help one night and I went in and helped. And by the next week I worked there full time and I've never looked back. I've cooked my way around the world since then and, you know, opened my own restaurant and now I've written a book.
So for you, it's not really work. It's a passion. You just love what you do.
I do. Yes. I mean, some days it is a four-letter word, but most of the time it's super fun.
Yeah, right. So, Southern baking, the title of your book, The Good Book of Southern Baking, you're very specific about this. And I want to get into this a little bit because when we say baking, and when we say pastry chef, I want to touch on this for a moment because pastry chef, I often hear people say on menus in certain restaurants, you'll see who's behind the scenes. You'll see the chef de cuisine. And then at the bottom, you're not necessarily at the bottom, but you'll see pastry chef. And I always wondered whether pastry chefs feel like they've sort of been relegated to the end of the list of credits. How do you feel about that?
I mean, I feel like we get the last sentence in a good conversation if you're working at a restaurant that you love with a chef that you love. You know, it is... Usually, for me, it was a conscious choice to go into pastry and focus on that. And I've always loved the challenge of working with and for different chefs in different cuisines and different restaurants and different styles and be able to, like, have that last sentence at the end. Like, I get the last impression. Like, they have to worry about the first, I get the last. And that feels like a really beautiful challenge to have for everybody that comes to the restaurant.
So you take the positive side of it. I like that. So pastry chef is a bit of a misnomer in some respects because you do baking, you make custards, you make all kinds of things. Well, aren't necessarily pastry. Mm-hmm. So is pastry chef a good description?
I mean, I think so. I think all like bread and, you know, chocolate. So all that stuff is under the umbrella of pastry.
Yeah.
We're not all pastry chefs are bakers and not all bakers are pastry chefs. Like, I mean, I get it. I think it's, for me, it's fine.
Now, is that your dog, Kinsey, that I can hear?
No, I'm at the restaurant. So right now it's just somebody's getting ice
Okay. I thought maybe it was listening to your dogs sort of snuffling around there, but no. Okay. Yeah. So let's talk about recipes. Let's talk about putting this book together. As I already said, you've got, and I'm going to hold it up again so people can see, you've got a lot of recipes in here. How many? Over 100?
There are 135.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of those recipes, like specifically in the cake chapter, like there's one cake which might be the most intimidating recipe in the whole book, has like 7 different recipes in it. So it's 135 items with multiple recipes.
Which cake is that? Which recipe is that?
Both versions of the Dobash cake.
Oh, okay.
Some people call it Dobash down here.
Yes. So putting a recipe book together. I mean, this is more than just recipes. This is you talking about your love of what you do. And there's something that you say. There's a panel on not every page, but a lot of the pages, and the heading is "What's mine is yours." Can you talk about that?
Yeah. There's a page towards the back that's also titled "Let's call it love," and it explains the "What's mine is yours." And both of the titles of that of those sections are my favorite songs by the band Sleater-Kinney.
Yes.
And they talk, number one, "What's mine is yours" just speaks to like anything that I know I want to share with you is the whole point of those little boxes. It's like
right.
A little like bonus gift with purchase, basically. But for me, the song "What's mine is yours" is also on an album that sort of tore apart that band and put it back together in a new creative way so that they could continue evolving moving forward. And Carrie Brownstein talks about it in her book about how everything was just broken apart and they had to find their way back. And that is a lot of the way that I like to cook, or the way that I just naturally found that I cook is to tear something apart and like learn every bit of it and put it together in a new way.
I love it. So and we're going to go off on a little bit of a tangent here. Now we've talked about music a little bit. I just want to find out from you, obviously Sleater-Kinney is very important to you because you named your dog Kinney after Sleater-Kinney.
Yep, my dog is.
Music is very important to you, isn't it? In just in your life. Do you listen to music when you're working?
I used to not, but since we've come back from COVID, you know, if there was anything to learn in quarantine and think about and sort of reprioritize, it was how to have more fun with what we're doing and how to really be inspired to be in a space that feels really hard to be in going through this. So now we blast music all day, every day.
Right.
So much more fun now.
Putting these, one of the things, I think I already mentioned this, one of the things that is fascinating for me about your book is that you have made these recipes easy to understand, what to do, the process, the ingredients. I mean, you've written it so I can do it. And I want to know from you, Kelly, about as you collating the information, putting it together, it's not easy writing out recipes. I've done it myself, and I it's much harder than you think. So doing over 100, that's got to be quite the job that you had in front of you.
Yeah, it took 3 years to put together, and I thought I was really good at writing recipes, and I partnered up with Kate Headings to do this book. And Kate was responsible for most of the recipes that have been in Food & Wine magazine for years. And so the first recipe I sent her was one I was really confident in, because I've written it 100 times. I know it like the back of my hand. I thought it was really thorough and step-by-step, and she just sent it back and it was all red. Like everything that I learned that I take for granted in a professional kitchen had to be removed from the process.
Yeah.
And I learned that I'm a really, really mediocre home baker, maybe a bad home baker, because I never did it. And that process was super fun for me to learn and sort of strip away all the intuitiveness that I have in a professional kitchen where everything's like right there where you need it, you know, with reach, there's muscle memory behind it. So it was a really fun, it was hard, but it was a really fun process to learn how to bake at home and make sure those recipes work.
As we're talking about recipes, let's talk about being in the kitchen and the tools that you use, the utensils, and you talk about this in your book, at the beginning of your book, and I'm just wondering if you can just tell my listeners just a couple of things that you think are essential for a baker to have in the kitchen. Or a pastry chef.
I think the most important thing that's often taken for granted is to have a really sharp knife. Because you still need that when you're, like, baking is essentially cooking, and to have sharp tools is necessary. I also really love a small offset spatula. You can ice cakes, you can cut things, you can, you know, scoop things up. Like, it's an all-purpose tool. I usually have one in my back pocket. And also a bowl scraper, which is usually a piece of plastic that's flat on one side and then rounded on the other. So you can very easily get everything out of a bowl. Or on the other side, if you're using the flat side, if you're using herbs or something, you can just scoop them up. Or chocolate that you've chopped on a cutting board, you can just scoop it up and put it where it belongs very quickly without much mess.
See, just in that description that you gave us there, there's so many different areas I could go off on, so many tangents I want to talk about, but let's just for a moment, for me, so I can just keep focused here, let's stay on talking about recipes, because you said earlier on about Southern cooking, about not using measurements and just sort of, I don't know, doing it with the feel, I guess, but how important is it with these recipes that you actually follow the measurements?
I think it's really, my advice is this, like, follow the directions, figure out what the outcome is, what you like about it, maybe what you want to change about it. And then, like, once you know the foundation, go have fun with it, figure it out. The biggest piece of advice I have for anybody that wants to play with it is, like, make one change at a time. Don't make like 20 changes all of a sudden. And then you don't know how things affected what, but I think it's a really good idea for pastry to learn a couple of foundational recipes and then just have a lot of fun with them.
What about, and people have told me this, that they've gotten a recipe wrong because they're reading the recipe as they go. And it always seems to me, and I don't know, you're shaking your head. Yeah. So tell me about that. What's the rule? What's the first rule there?
The rule is to read the entire recipe. For this book, I wrote a bunch of stuff up front that I think is important to read about why I make the choices I do or what's really important to pay attention to in the recipes to have the best outcome. But you always read the whole recipe because there may be something at the bottom that wasn't, you know, in the list of recipes that's usually up front.
Yes.
It may not say that your eggs or your butter needs to be room temperature, but it says it at the bottom. And the difference between using cold butter where you're supposed to use room temperature, it will affect the entire item. So
yes,
read it start to finish and then read it along as you go. That's what I do.
What about, Chef Kelly, ingredients? How important is it, again, with reading a recipe, reading your recipes, to make sure that you follow precisely what you have used?
Some places it's more important than others. I have strong opinions on basically using the best ingredients you have locally, like the best buttermilk, the best eggs, all that stuff. You know, when it comes to things like chocolate, I have a preference for Valrhona, but you should use whatever you like. So I think there's a lot of, flexibility based on what's available to you, and what you want to be eating. And as long as you love what you're starting with, the end thing you get is probably going to be pretty delicious to you. So that's the rule.
My guest is Chef Kelly Fields. Her book is called The Good Book of Southern Baking, a revival of biscuits, cakes, and cornbread. Chef Kelly, again, putting the book together, I know that it was fun for you, but it was hard work. It was 3 years. But there's one thing I have to talk about and share with my audience, and that is the photographs in this book. They're so splendid. Talk to me about those.
The photographs are nothing I can take credit for. We had a really amazing team put together. Oriana Corinne, who is based in L.A., is a photographer, and they put together the team of their assistant, prop stylist, and the food stylist team, and brought everybody together in New Orleans, and we did a 10-day photo shoot in the living room of an Airbnb, and that's how that book came to be. And it was 100% Oriana's perspective and vision that really, like, I wanted to take away the like preciousness of Southern baking and just have it be gritty and real. I just think they did such a phenomenal job getting their message across.
I agree. It really conjures up, as you say, we bring honest, low country southern fare to New Orleans while celebrating all we have around us with simple, nostalgic dishes that are served with intention and care. And I like to think that we pay tribute to the South's sense of belonging. And I think the photographs complement so incredibly well. Maybe that's why I drool when I'm opening your book and I'm reading through it. I'm just literally drooling. It's wonderful stuff. Kelly, in cooking and baking is what you do. There are specific, like in any cooking, there's rules and regulations and things that you have to, you know, make sure that you do properly. I would just like to know from you, after having read your book, what things would you, are some of the big, maybe just a couple of big no-nos that you just, in your kitchen, you forbid, or you just tell people this cannot be done?
Man, I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, that's the whole thing. There's really simple rules. Like, you shouldn't put, you know, salt on top or sugar on top of eggs and let them sit because they'll cook. Or, you know, yeast needs its own thing. But, you know, big picture rules boil down to, like, cross-contamination. And that's about it. Otherwise, all the rules are made to be broken, in my opinion.
I see. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Here's something which I, again, after reading your book, I wanted to ask you about, and that's savory and sweet, and mixing the two, or pastries with herbs in, or using mint, or herbs that are not considered sweet. Talk to me about that, about the mixture of different tastes.
Yeah, again, I think it goes back to no rules other than what you like or what you want to play with or what you want to try. And I think we have as much fun here at the restaurant taking biscuits like and adding like cheese and serrano peppers, and then we take it a step further and like make it like a biscuit. We make pretzel biscuits basically, where we do the lye solution that you need to do for a traditional pretzel and cover it in salt, and it's phenomenal. It wasn't my idea. I wish it was. It was one of the great guys that has worked for me. And again, I don't think there's anything off limits that's too savory to add into a baked good.
What I notice about your recipes is that you've taken ideas, it seems to me, or you've taken the germ of a recipe from all over the place, even though they've ended up in as you call southern cooking. But it seems like you've got different things coming from different locales. Talk to me about that, because you've traveled around the world. Talk to me about just gleaning some of those ideas from cooking in Asia or in Europe or wherever.
For me, like, traveling was a lot about learning ingredients and having an opportunity to taste things together that grow together in other parts of the world that I would have never seen otherwise. And bringing that back and applying it to what I get to do in the kitchen every day in the South. And for me, it really, when I think about a hummingbird cake and where it comes from, and it's really like it comes from the islands and Jamaica is where it's traced back to, is, you know, how did they use their ingredients? Why did they choose this flavor? And like, think about how somebody thought about that cake and thought it up, and how I can highlight that, and how I can like honor all of the places, all the people that like put so much thought into all of these things we just have as traditions today. Yeah.
Out of all these lovely recipes and all these gorgeous photographs and all this stuff that make you drool, does Chef Kelly Fields have a big favorite?
My favorites change every day. So I love the chocolate pudding. I like to eat that warm, which is how we ate it growing up as kids. And I didn't realize how unusual that was until I was baking professionally. And I really love chocolate cake in general. That blackout cake is extraordinary. I love it. It's one of my favorite things. And the lemon chiffon pie that my great aunt Jean would make every time I went to her house is a really, like, really special recipe to me just because of the memories that it brings up.
So your restaurant in New Orleans is called Willa Jean. let's talk about that just for a moment. Just tell us about how that came to be. What, 2015 you opened it?
Right, August of 2015, so we just turned five. The name comes from my grandmother, my father's mom, who was a northerner and also a horrible cook. ironically, there's the poetry of learning how to bake from my grandmother is not a true story when it comes to that grandmother. But she was exactly who she was. She was very sort of sassy and stubborn and, you know, the strongest woman I knew growing up without really understanding what that meant. But she was also the biggest cheerleader and biggest supporter of me in life. And especially when I decided to start doing this as a career, she really helped make it a reality for me and really championed me to do it and encouraged me to go work for chefs that I wanted to emulate one day. And also somehow talked me into going to culinary school.
Good for her.
So, you know, when I was opening this restaurant, I thought about what was important to me and, you know, my grandmother's way of being supportive and, you know, being completely open and welcoming and completely herself without apology was what rang out. And it's what I wanted to be able to do with this restaurant. So it came very naturally that became the name of the space.
I need to ask you this because of the times that we're living in, because of the pandemic and because of where you are in New Orleans, because of horrible weather that hits that area. And you've just had some, I mean, is it raining there right now as we're speaking?
No, we got really super lucky this week, yesterday.
Oh, you did, yeah.
Yeah, the storm veered a little east, so our neighbors over in Mississippi are, they're getting the storm right now, as a matter of fact.
Right.
Yeah, it's a wild time to be alive.
yes, it is. So I don't want to make a big deal about the pandemic and just, but it does affect everybody. It's affected all of us. Here am I. I'm in isolation. You're in your kitchen. Things have changed to some degree. Anything that you can talk about from your point of view as a chef, as a restaurant owner, how the pandemic has affected you?
I mean, for me personally, it's been an opportunity for me to sort of reprioritize what's actually important to me, which looks a lot different than the track that I've been on the last few years. And I feel like before the pandemic, I didn't understand how over seriously we were all taking ourselves here, and how much we had moved away from or stopped grounding ourselves in the reason we're here and stopped having so much fun and just offering warm hospitality because it's who we are.
Yes.
And so for us to pause and have to shut down and now reopen is a really beautiful time to have a rebirth and get back to the roots of why we're all here, why we all love being part of this industry and part of the community, and really just get back to loving everything and caring about what we're doing in a not very serious, overly serious, ego-centered way.
So well said, Kelly. You know, one of the things about the restaurant business and chefs over the last, 20 years, last two decades, it's become this whole sort of celebrity, I'm cleverer and trendier than you thing. And this is one of the things I think that your book really espouses. It's just getting back to basics. And it's just, that's what I love about it. It's charming and readable and makes me drool at the same time.
That means a lot.
Yeah, for you, last question. For you, for Chef Kelly Fields, what's the big takeaway you would like people to have from reading the good book of Southern Baking?
I mean, I think the biggest thing is anybody can do it. Like, if I can bake anything in that book, I think anybody can. And I think remembering to have fun doing it and be open to learning new things, because if you mess something up or if it doesn't look, you know, Instagram perfect or whatever, it's probably still 100% delicious.
Yes.
And to really, like, celebrate that.
That was the second to last question. Do you eat? Do you eat one of your creations every day? Do you eat dessert every day?
Man, I try not to. I've tried to feel a bit healthier because, you know, two years before I opened this restaurant, I started baking cookies every day to get our chocolate chip cookie right. And even this morning when I walked in, like, I automatically, muscle memory, don't even think about it, grab cookie dough and eat it every morning.
And oh my goodness.
I have every day for the last 7 years almost.
So. Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
I can't help it. But it doesn't get old at the same time.
No, of course not. You're a lot of fun. The book is a terrific read. It really is. Even if you're not really, and I'm going to tell everybody this, even if you're not really into cooking, I think this is just a great book to read and look at. It's just it's a terrific book just to pick up and just indulge in. The book is called The Good Book of Southern Baking, A Revival of Biscuits, Cakes, and Cornbread. My guest, Chef Kelly Fields. Chef Kelly Fields, thank you so very much for joining us at Life Elsewhere.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Yes, that was Slater Kinney. What's Mine Is Yours, a song that is very special to Chef Kelly Fields. The music you heard earlier on was Porridge Radio with 7 Seconds, in my opinion, one of the best pop songs I've heard for ages. A big thank you to my guests and a large thank you to you for listening. Let me know what you think of Life Elsewhere. My email address comes up in a moment. Jot it down, please. Over on Life Elsewhere Music, we have another round of Jukebox Jury with a stellar lineup of guests, comedian and musician
Dave Hill, singer, songwriter, and author Amy Rigby, musician, actor, and radio host The Shand, and Nancy Curls of Spartan Jetplex and Grimalkind Records fame. Till next time, be well, be safe, and as always, please be nice. It costs nothing.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Van, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O. Life Elsewhere is produced at the studios of WMNF Tampa.